This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September 14th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA and your State Society of CPAs. And what we're going to take a look at this week is a number of developments that took place in federal taxes. And it turns out this was a relatively busy week, so we have a number of things to discuss here. First, probably not going to affect many of your clients, but if it does, it's a pretty big effect, I guess. The IRS is telling people they will no longer accept checks that are $100 million or more in the payment of taxes. This came out in announcement 2015-36. The IRS announced they're going to stop accepting any check that gets to $100 million or more. Now, that doesn't mean that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates will stop having to pay any taxes. What that does mean, though, is that they're going to have to transfer the money in some way other than writing a check to the IRS. We have no idea if Warren or Bill were writing checks that way, but we do know the IRS told us that 14 checks came in that way this past tax season. So effective January 1st of next year, the IRS will simply return such items. This will not be a valid way to pay taxes. The reason for this is because the Federal Reserve System will not process such checks. They have to be manually run through because the system's not set up to handle anything of that size, at least not in the form of a paper check. Also, the IRS points out this is a somewhat risky way to send a $100 million plus check. It seems a little iffy. And the IRS just decides that actually we're just not going to handle those. The federal government has announced and told all agencies to stop accepting such checks. So what a taxpayer who's going to have that happen is going to have to do is either they're going to need to write two checks. That, by the way, appears to be a solution to this. If you write a check for $90 million plus $10 million, then you're fine. Or the other issue is that we're going to have to effectively use an electronic method to transfer checks in. So we'll do it via electronic means. Either one of those should work. But if you have one of these clients and your clients were one of those 14 checks, they will need to change their ways. And I guess the other side of this, if they want to make that fourth quarter estimate, they have to get it paid before the end of December if they want to send the check in with that, at least a single check. Next, we go to the case of Friedman versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-177 that was issued on September 10th. This is a case of a taxpayer that tried to apply the open transaction doctrine. Now, what the taxpayers did was they loaned money to their daughter's S Corporation. The S Corporation paid interest on this note in the year in question. So it paid interest payments. It actually took a deduction. The interest in question was just under $200,000. Now, while the S Corporation took a deduction for that interest, the taxpayers decided that most of that interest should represent a return of principal. They decided that because they said the S Corporation had been defrauded, and essentially there was no chance they would get the money back, that a insurance agent had defrauded the company. This particular agent was actually charged with criminal issues, but did not directly tell us how much supposedly he took from this company, nor did they have any evidence about how much what the assets of the company were in the year in question. Nevertheless, the problem is they said, well, we should be able to use the open transaction doctrine. The open transaction doctrine generally says that if you have a highly uncertain situation, it's used, as the Supreme Court told us, used in very rare situations, a taxpayer can be allowed to get a recovery of basis before having to pick up any item of income if, in fact, it is extraordinarily speculative with regard to the actual recovery of the income. Now, it's been used in a couple of cases. Most recently, probably the Fisher case dealing with life insurance company demutualization was one where the Court of Claims decided that it was a open transaction doctrine. But as the Supreme Court told us, this is not used very often. And for these taxpayers, unfortunately, the tax court said, no, this isn't one of those cases. They noted that, in fact, it was paid as interest. They received the interest. There's no question they did. That wasn't the question. Whether they'll receive principal, well, that's open, but that's a different issue. Always were speculative. Secondly, the court pointed out that even if we decided this was a bad debt, at best they could get a $3,000 loss. They already had $3,000 in capital losses that they were claiming on the return. So basically, net capital losses. So basically it was a moot point. But the court did point out that in any event, not being able to show any evidence about the assets of the company at the time or the ability of the company to pay or when, in fact, the item became uncollectible. They hadn't actually even shown it was a bad debt at that point. So basically, the taxpayers were clobbered. The bigger problem was that the taxpayers also got nailed with the substantial understatement of tax penalty. Even though the taxpayers apparently had put together a theory based on a bunch of open transaction cases, doctrine cases that they believed justified their position, the court found that it didn't meet substantial authority. Now, that's a bit of an issue and a bit of a problem, because what you're going to find sometimes is sometimes clients want you to take aggressive positions. Sometimes they say, you know, as in this case, well, my daughter's not going to be able to pay me. I shouldn't have to pick up that interest. Merely reaching for and finding some way of justifying a non-deduction may come back and bite the taxpayer. In this case, it did. They got nailed for the penalty because even though they had a claim justification, they did not, in fact, as far as the court was concerned, have enough to have substantial authority. Substantial authority means not just that you could argue in favor of it, but that your authority is essentially better than the competing authorities out there, even if ultimately you lose the case. That wasn't the case in this situation. Now, interestingly enough, there was no claim of a reasonable cause defense based on reliance on a tax professional. So it's possible, and it seems very likely in this case, what may have happened is that this was what counsel tried to use as a Hail Mary pass to justify the taxpayer's position after the fact. And that probably is why we don't see any claim of reasonable cause. The taxpayer might be able to get out of this with reasonable cause had they received an opinion from a competent tax professional, attorney, CPA, who had the background to handle this. The problem there would be that the CPA or attorney now is potentially subject to sanction. Because what would have happened in that case is, yes, the client may get out of that penalty, but let's say the CPA that told the client this was fine and took the position on the return might find him or herself now open to sanctions under Section 6694 because the position still didn't have substantial authority. The taxpayer got out of the penalty, but the whole point of those changes to 6694 was if that happens, then the IRS will be able to turn around and look to the preparer to pick up some of that, to pick up the penalty if, in fact, they had relied on the preparer. Next up, we have more fun with bad debts and banks. This is Clark versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-175. Story is pretty much a standard one on a 1099-C problem. The taxpayer had failed to pay on her car loan, and she had stopped paying on the loan back a number of years earlier. She defaulted, and the item was repossessed a number of years earlier. There was still a balance due on the loan after the repossessed car was sold. The bank, or basically the finance company, had attempted to collect the money by sending it to 5 different collection agencies, each one of which failed to collect and send it back to the bank. Eventually, the bank decided to write off the debt. And when they finally wrote that debt off, they did so, you know, many years later. Probably due to an expiration of a statute would not be a bad way to assume as to why suddenly, you know, they had to give up on the collection agencies after trying the 5. What the catch was that the taxpayer said, wait, that's a wrong year. Well, actually, she first tried to say, I didn't get the 1099. Not surprisingly, when you wait 5 to 6 years to send a 1099-C, sometimes people move. And it's not unusual for the taxpayer not to get the 1099-C, which is what appears to have happened in this case. As the court pointed out, whether you got it or not, if there's income in that year, you have to report it. But the court did agree that, in fact, because she had defaulted on the loan, and that 3 years after that default had expired many years before the year when the 1099 was issued, they said, well, the standard basic presumption of the 36-month rule for a covered entity, in this case for a bank, a finance company, if they have no collections, no payments for 36 months, and there's no substantial collection activity, then there is a presumption that the debt has been canceled. And the court held that the IRS had failed to overcome that presumption. Even though it had been sent to collections agencies, the tax court ruled in this case, which is what's interesting, that merely sending the debt to a collection agency is not by itself evidence of substantial collection activities. The IRS would have had to have shown what the collection agencies did, which they failed to show. Therefore, even though Clark had actually had cancellation of debt income, there's no question of that, The reality was the IRS had waited too long, and the year in question, the year before the court, was not the year when it happened. Rather, it's a year that's now most likely closed for assessment. Next up, we're going to take a look at Private Letter Ruling 2015-36006. This particular ruling deals with the origin of the claim doctrine as applied to a patent dispute. Now, I know our clients all tend to believe that legal fees are always deductible, but in reality, legal fees are only deductible if you can establish the business reason for them. And to look at the reason for a legal claim, you know, when we talk about defense of a legal claim, you tend to look at the concept called origin of the claim. Why did the claim arise? In this case, the taxpayer had been, was a licensee of a patent that had been given that's from a related party. They discovered a third party was violating that patent. They informed the company that held the patent, and under their agreement, they were charged with defending it as well. So they went in to defend the patent. Suit was brought, and the defendant argued, not unusually, when you have a patent infringement claim, there'll be two claims you'll argue. Number one, you'll say what we're doing really doesn't infringe on your patent. And then number two, they said, well, the patent you got anyway wasn't validly issued, so even if we did infringe, there is no patent upon which for us to infringe upon. Now, interestingly enough, under the regulations for when we deal with intangible assets, which are very similar to the regulations for tangible assets for capitalization, payments made in defense of title have to be capitalized. But payments that aren't in defense of title generally do not have to be. The IRS ruled in this case that this did not represent a defense of title. They did not doubt that the patent, well, you know, that this process was owned. They didn't claim the process wasn't owned or somebody else was a patent holder. Rather, they challenged the validity of the patent and they challenged whether their actions were infringing. And the concern probably was more to the validity of the patent. Was that going to be considered by the IRS a challenge to title? In this case, it was not. So the IRS said, well, we can deduct it. Next up, we are beginning to again see the IRS having to deal with taxpayers who are need relief from failing to have made a portability election. This is Private Letter Ruling 2015-36005. In this particular ruling, the taxpayer had failed to file a Form 706 to elect portability after her husband passed away. Now, as we all know, the portability election under Section 2010 says that I can take the unused exclusion from my spouse's, you know, my spouse's 5 points whatever million when the year that they die, and we're not sure, you know, I don't recall here which year the spouse died, but it would have been in excess of 5 million. I can take that amount, and if an election's made on the decedent's return, I, as the surviving spouse, will be able to use that so long as I don't remarry and essentially have that other, that spouse I marry later die on me before I can divorce them, because effectively, you know, my last predeceased spouse is the only one I can use. Well, in this case, they failed to make the election. It was determined that they wanted to make it. So they asked for a waiver of the election date. Now, we're beginning to see these again because that temporary provision that gave everybody a second chance expired at the end of last year. So now we're back in having to ask for extensions when people notice this quite often. Maybe when you change preparers, change law firms, somebody notices this and says, oh, we should have filed and asked for this. So the private letter ruling was requested. Now, the IRS granted it, but it is important to understand there is a big contingency that you're likely to see in these others. The IRS says, yes, we decided you aren't second guessing. You just didn't. You weren't told about this election. You would have made it had you known. You would have filed the 706. We grant you that right. However, this is all contingent on us not finding that your spouse should have filed a 706. Note that doesn't mean that your spouse would have had tax due on the estate tax return, because most likely in a case like this, we're seeing a case where, you know, the husband left the estate to the surviving spouse. So there would have been 100% marital exclusion, but rather if a 706 should have been filed, whether or not there would have been tax due, the IRS position is they cannot waive that. They argue that if a date is set by law and if the 706 is required, the law says you have to make the portability election on a timely filed 706. The IRS position is if no 706 is required, then the fact that the date they set in regulation would be the same date it would have been due means that they set the date as the agency, and as the agency, they have the right to waive it. But if Congress sets the date and Congress doesn't explicitly grant the IRS the right to waive a date, they have no right. So don't be surprised to see all of these late portability elections say that it only applies if no 706 were due. Flip side of that is, if you get a client discovered they should have filed a 706, at this point, unless Congress acts, it appears even when you go back and file that 706, you're not going to be able to allow the client to make a portability election on that late filed 706. Next up, we're going to go back and look at a case we discussed earlier. This is the Mikkel case versus, which will be Mikkel versus Commissioner. We talked about this back in April. This was the case, you may remember, where the taxpayers had a gift and that if there was a challenge to be made to the will or trust, it was a gift to a trust. We were talking about a present interest here. And if there was a challenge to be made, it had to go through a panel composed of members of the religious, of the same religious persuasion as the taxpayer who established the trust. The IRS had argued that, in fact, that was a, that there was, in fact, not a present interest because there was no effective right for the person to take the money. The tax court had disagreed in that case, so the taxpayer prevailed on that present interest matter. Now the taxpayer is coming back to ask for fees. Remember, if you prevail, if you are essentially, if you prevail completely and the IRS position was not justified, substantially justified, then you have a right to get legal fees, at least reasonable legal fees paid. However, the court noted in the original opinion, they found the document was unclear. And based on their interpretation of the document that they came to, they determined there was a present interest. But the court said it was unclear. The document didn't say for sure. It's plausible to read it the other way. The court read it. They said, well, they felt after studying it that it could be read, you know, that it should be read the way the taxpayer wanted to. But they said the IRS position was not unreasonable. So even though the IRS lost the case, their position was not found itself to be unreasonable. Now, another case that we're returning to here is the case of the Law Office of John H. Eggerston, which came back from last October. This time, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals heard his appeal. Mr. Eggerston, you may remember, had an S corporation with an ESOP. He did not believe in the year in question that the excise tax applied to him, that there was a prohibited allocation of securities to him in that year. The IRS disagreed, took him to court. The tax court agreed. However, they did so more than 3 years after the tax would have been due. Now, the IRS went back and forth about whether or not the statute was open, or, you know, whether or not, or how the statute would still be open. But eventually, the tax court ruled that because no Form 5330 had been filed, in essence, the IRS was never put on notice. The 5500 was not enough by itself to put the IRS on notice about this, nor was the S-Corp return. Mr. Eggerston basically appealed this. The Sixth Circuit agreed with that. They noted it may seem unfair that, you know, you didn't believe, you legitimately did not believe the tax applied. You had reasons for believing that. But the fact was, when you didn't file the 5330, the statute never started. And as they said, that may be unfair, but it's the way the law is written. So if you want that changed, your problem is you need to go back to Congress to get it changed. Next up, the IRS ends the appeals arbitration program. This was in Revenue Procedure 2015-44. Now, the appeals arbitration program is being shut down by the IRS. And that was a pilot program that was mandated by Congress many years ago. The IRS ran the program for 14 years. During the 14 years, what they discovered was nobody wanted to use it. This was a program where both the IRS and the taxpayer had to agree to submit to binding arbitration that was run by appeals on the issue. In the 14 years, it only resolved two cases. The IRS has announced because of that, they decided that nobody seems to be that interested in it. Therefore, they said, what we're going to do is shut the program down. We tried it, Congress. Nobody used it, Congress, which from my standpoint is not surprising, an arbitration program where appeals provides, where we're using arbitrators. Reality is, like it or not, we're that far along in the process, counsel is likely going to want to take their chances in court rather than go to binding arbitration. It sounds good, but generally where we see binding arbitration used is where we have contracts that say you have to use it. Not often do we tend to see it used in disputes where somebody says later, why don't we go there? No, by then we're already fighting and we're heading to court. Let's take a look finally at one more issue. This is interesting. Snow days. The tax court found in a ruling and an order in a case of Gerlinek versus Commissioner, docket number 4358-15L, in an order dated August the 24th of 2015. The tax court took a look at a problem Mr. Gerlinek had. In this case, he used FedEx overnight, and it's important to note that, the type he did, FedEx first overnight. Service, I should say, first overnight to send the petition to the tax court on Friday. The last day for filing the tax court petition would be Monday. Now, as we know, we have a timely mailing is timely filing rule. It applies to tax court petitions as well as tax returns. So he gave it to FedEx. FedEx is an approved private delivery service. And he gave it to him on Friday, a whole day, you know, basically, you know, a few days early. They're going to deliver it on Monday. And he did it. He decided that it's probably important to get there early. So he had it. So as soon as the tax court opened, the FedEx delivery person is going to be there and is going to drop the petition on the tax court. All sounds well. Except a snowstorm hit the District of Columbia that weekend. And federal offices were ordered closed on Monday. So the tax court did not reopen until Tuesday. Therefore, when FedEx attempted a delivery on Monday, there was nobody there to answer the door. There was a rather cold FedEx delivery person probably, but there was nobody to answer the door. So they went back and FedEx delivered the petition on Tuesday. Well, that's a day late, but of course he mailed it on time, right? He gave it to FedEx on Friday, and Monday was the date he would have had to have put it into the system. But here's the problem. First overnight was not on the approved list. When the IRS put the original notice out, until last May, they hadn't gone back and revised it. First overnight was added by Federal Express after the original list was issued. And that list does not say Federal Express is approved. That list says the following specific services of Federal Express are approved. First overnight was not one of them. That was on the approved list because it didn't exist at the time the list was drawn up. The tax court ruled, and this is one to note because this would apply apparently to 1040, you know, if you're filing a 1040 or an 1120 or anything else using this, that because the service is not on the approved list, we'd seen this before with taxpayers that tried to use ground services from FedEx or UPS, and those aren't on the approved list, but this was somebody who tried to use an overnight service that happened not be on the approved list. Not on the approved list is not on the approved list. It didn't count. So he couldn't use the timely mailing as timely filing. But the court went back and decided that because of the snow day and the office being closed, they looked at the history of the provision and decided that because he could not physically deliver it on Tuesday, on Monday, that that was the same as being closed on Sunday. Therefore, as long as it was delivered on Tuesday, he was fine. So the tax court found it was still timely filed. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 14th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. You want to visit us at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com on the web for the source documents and more information about the cases we discussed this week. Also, be sure to join us next week when we talk about more unique development, shall we say, that come to us under the area of federal taxes.